This is X-Formation, brought to you by the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. I'm Will, and today, much like always, I am joined by my colleague, Caden Rosenbaum. And today we also have our other colleague, Eli Dorado. We're doing kind of the rounds. We're getting some new, fresh blood into these conversations. And I'm actually really, really excited about this because we're talking about space.
Yeah, so am I. And this is one of the issues that we're all pretty passionate about, space. I know I haven't written anything, but I like to watch movies about space. So I'm very interested in the topic, obviously.
Are you watching The Expanse?
No, I haven't. This is on my list to watch, but I can't get Mackenzie to stop watching.
Thank you, Eli.
It's so good.
Yeah, it is coming up.
You got to watch it.
Okay.
It really is. Space is this kind of interesting other part of policy that I don't think we talk about all that much, right? And what really seems to be driving it, at least in the last couple of weeks, has been there's been this reinvigoration, this conversation yet again of going to the moon, of going to Mars, the Artemis program, space launch system, like these issues, like, just keep on coming up over and over and over again. Not anything to really like bring a huge amount of news and media, but in the small little circles, the space circles that I know I follow and have been following now for a couple of years, and I know Eli follows this super closely, all these things make little bumps and waves, and it seems like we're not really getting anywhere personally, but I don't know, maybe that's it.
Well, I mean, we may have had some contact with the outside world, right? Have you seen the UFO videos? Do we have any theories about what that is? I have a theory. I think it's some kind of top secret government project, but you guys are the experts here. I want to hear what your theories are.
Our expert theories on the
UFO Pentagon videos. Report? Yeah, the Pentagon report.
So, has it been released yet, by the way?
Yes, the report came out on Friday.
I haven't even read that. Oh, wow.
I haven't read it, but I don't think there was any like shocking revelations in there, right? Otherwise you would have seen the headlines, but I don't think it's top secret stuff. Right. So I used to work with a guy who was a former, Navy F-18 pilot who knew like some of the people that came forward and talked about, the stuff they saw. And his perspective was like, look, if it was top secret stuff, like that happens, right? Like you actually, when you were flying an F-18, you do occasionally see top secret stuff. And then when you land, back on the carrier, someone pulls you aside and explains to you what you saw and why it's secret so that you don't screw up and you don't say something about it. Right. And so, I think that has clearly not happened here. Like the pilots have not been briefed on what they saw, which would be the normal thing that would happen. So I don't think it's classified stuff. So my leading explanation is it's all just a bunch of errors, right? Oh, so really? So it could be like that the radar system on the F-18s and on the surveillance ships and stuff like that, like those are all upgraded like right around the time that these sightings were started. So like it could be just like system errors. It could be like things like Mylar balloons like reflecting back radar in weird ways.
Other balloons.
It could be like so Mick West on YouTube has like debunked some of the data points, not all of them, but like he's sort of shown like, oh, if you account for the parallax effect, like this is completely not puzzling at all, or okay, this thing that we're looking at here, it looks like just a plane in the distance and that's all it really is. So I think like some of the data points have been debunked, like not all of them, but like that makes me like pretty confident that we'll like find like eventually if we continue to look into it, which who knows if we should.
Well, it's about to happen.
Like I think that it's going to get continually we're going to find new explanations for what actually this all is.
Will, are you buying it?
It's not little green men, right?
I mean, personally, I, let me say it like this. I've been following, I guess one of my like weird interests is the, all of the top secret tech. And so as much as I do know that, you know, as Eli had mentioned, there people are pulled aside and kind of told what's going on when they come across American technology, I've been wondering more and more about outside technology, about China, Russia, and other non agencies and non entities potentially not interfering, but they're being these other sorts of, you know, kind of non-governmental like actors that are going on in the space, or governmental actors that are adversarial actors. You know, the one, so I was mentioning this to Eli a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if you followed up on this, but there was a guy that had a jetpack in LA, right? The LA jetpack guy. Yeah. I'm assuming it. Yeah. And so like that kind of stuff, I'm just like, okay, well, if this is clearly occurring, we know it's occurring. There's very, very, very clear video. I have a tendency to probably agree that there is just, you know, like clutter and a whole bunch of problems, phenomenon, all those kind of related things. But in the things that look probably more like drones, they probably are drones of some sort. But that's a whole different thing. We're already a couple minutes in here. We're almost 6 minutes into this conversation. And to the actual reason, what we're actually talking about today would be about the space launch system and about space. And again, all these things that are going on. So,
yeah. Well, okay. Right. So both of you are pretty unenthused with the space launch system. Eli in 2020 wrote an article and it was titled "The Space Launch System is an Irredeemable Mistake." He wrote a separate article that was calling it the swamp that should be drained, which I thought was funny. That was a good one. And Will has an article that came out recently in the National Review about Bill Nelson and NASA's flawed vision, which is almost entirely centered on SLS. I think we should probably start with Eli on this. He goes the furthest back in my knowledge on the SLS. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah, it's an irredeemable mistake. So I would stand by that. It's basically, you know, I think that the real problem with space policy is that, like, none of the politicians actually care that much about progress in space. And so the people who are on the space committees in Congress, like, what they actually care about is like, well, let's, you know, there's people in my district or my home state that that work in this industry and they care about it and I want their votes. And like, I'm going to try to funnel money to them. And that's really how I'm going to use my perch here, because I don't really care about progress in space because I'm a member of Congress, right? And I have many other
Texas
things I care about.
Florida, right? Always, yeah. Texas and Florida seem to be people.
But it's more than that. Like Richard Shelby in Alabama, right? Like Louisiana, like other states, like the SLS program has suppliers in every state. Right. And that's like very deliberate. The F-35 did the same thing. Why? Right. And because if you get a supplier in every state, you get the entire Senate delegation of every state is, you know, get, so you can have some pressure
going on there.
Yes, of
but
course.
It's not like engineering calculus. It's like political calculus.
No, it's totally political. Right. Yeah, and so these big programs that that are, you know, always inevitably end up being over budget, behind schedule, and, you know, frankly, unsafe, failing to meet performance targets, including safety. They're actually kind of popular in Congress. A commercial company that's coming along and said, like, I'm going to build something a lot better, they have an uphill battle because Congress doesn't necessarily like that.
Yeah, I mean, they're competing directly with the government, right? I mean, and Will, exactly. Will has written about this too. How long was it since the SLS was, this project was launched? And then finally, I think a year from now, we maybe actually will see a real launch. You wrote about this, Will.
Yeah, I did. When was the original? 2007, I think. I'm going to have to look that one up, to be very honest. I know that there have been extensive delays.
So if you actually, you can think of it in a number of different ways, right? So this is the space launch system was designed to reuse parts and engineering from the space shuttle and from the Constellation program, which was like sort of George W. Bush era rocket, right? Mm-hmm. And which was also, it was like canceled because it was a bad idea.
And so, that's the reason why I hesitate about the timing, because there is this clear overlap as Eli is clearly showing, that there's this clear overlap between all these sorts of projects that, you know, even the space shuttle was itself this kind of, you know, reaction towards the was its own sort of reaction towards the moon missions, right? There's this like really interesting kind of history, this narrative that you see that stretches even back into the 50s, even before the Soviet space race, with regards to space technology. You know,
just the original combined effort of government contracts gone amok. Is that what I'm hearing?
So my point is like the flight heritage of some of these components goes back like 40 or 50 years.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, like it is really in some sense like a really, really old program. And it inherits a lot of the, you know, a lot of the mistakes that were made on the space shuttle. Right. And all the design decisions made for Constellation as well. When it was, you know, when those programs, when the Constellation program shut down and they were like, okay, we need a new system here. Like there was no Artemis program, right? There was nothing that they were designing this rocket for.
Yeah,
there was no moon mission. Like no one was going anywhere besides low Earth orbit. And so this was literally a rocket to nowhere, right? Like this was like, there was no plan to use it for anything. So it is completely unmoored from any like real world space exploration goal. It was completely notional. Like let's just make sure that the people who used to work on the space shuttle and Constellation don't get laid off.
Well, let's move then to the other government project that I'm thinking about, the International Space Station. Will wrote about this in 2018 for the American Action Forum. Really interesting piece, very long, very thorough. Will, I wanted to start with the disrepair, right? So there have been some statements that is kind of falling into disrepair.
Well, I mean, so it's important to know that obviously the space station is in this, I shouldn't say, you know, maybe I was a little bit too harsh back then that it is falling into disrepair. These modules, and to be very blunt, you know, the ISS is obviously just a series of modules that are all put together. But these modules themselves are constantly bombarded with small little particles, sand dust, super fast sand dust particles that literally rip through the station. And there just needs to be constant repair on all of these elements. And so what you have is you only have a kind of a certain useful life to all of these modules, and there needs to be constant repair. I mean, we've even seen this even in the last 2 to 3 years, that small little ruptures and small little holes it forces all of the astronauts on, or the cosmonauts as they may be, into one part of the, you know, one part of the space station. And they have to basically brace for these things to constantly, again, to bombard the International Space Station. So the point is that, okay, if we're going to have an International Space Station, there is only a useful life. And from my understanding, it is to about 2030 or somewhere around there for the majority of these modules, right? That what needs to happen is that there has been a useful life in probably 2 or 3 years ago, from my understanding, it was probably the mid-aughts that most of the major components are kind of getting towards the end of their useful life. And you're going to need to start decommissioning one way or another. You're going to need to start decommissioning parts. Now, some of the older sections...
It was supposed to be decommissioned in 2015, wasn't it?
Yes, to an effect, yes, it was supposed to be decommissioned in 2015. But there had never been an idea, or there had never been a concept or there had never been a plan to take the International Space Station down from space. So as much as we do talk about, as much as this project was meant to create the International Space Station, a lot of it was kind of cobbled together in the way that the space launch system was put together as well. I mean, the purpose really was to keep Russian scientists continuously employed at the fall of the Soviet Union. So it constantly had this pushing of, this is our way to build goodwill with Russia, with the new country. And in part, I don't want to say that's kind of outlived its usefulness as an argument, but at least as the kind of national security, the kind of national driver for the International Space Station, that was one of the main arguments for quite some time. That no longer really exists, right? We clearly see this new, and we'll get into it later, but we see this new commercialization of space. We see a whole bunch of new companies come into the foray, and a whole bunch of new technologies, not new technologies, but new players come into the foray as well. So the question now becomes, well, what do we do with this International Space Station? And I think it was only in April that it was announced that at least there's going to be more development of, you know, and again, we're going to talk about it here shortly, but more commercialization, probably more private players getting into the International Space Station space. There's probably parts of it are going to get decommissioned, and, you know, they probably will either, they'll try to take as many useful elements as possible, but some of it will probably be, you know, basically put into the ocean while other parts are developed, and there'll be, you know, continual refinement of that. So there's a lot that's happening with the International Space Station. I know that NASA, from my understanding, is kind of in the middle of this process right now, and that they will have a better sense. They've been working with some suppliers. I think they have three different people right now working on this. And so we're not like at a final stage of where we know with the International Space Station, where the ISS is going to go, but kind of in the middle of that process and figuring out what it should look like. And I'm thankful for this, because we have been needing to think through this since I wrote this in 2018. I said that, you know, we just need, I don't know if decommissioning the entire space station itself is necessarily a good idea. And obviously it has been very helpful in supporting a whole range of players in this space. But at the same time, we needed to think about what the next stage is, because 2030 is coming really, really, really quickly.
Well, and you know, it's literally the most expensive object humans have ever built.
What is it, right? $1 billion a day?
I think in terms of like in today's dollars, I think if you add it all up, it costs like $150 billion to build.
What? Well,
so even a space shuttle launch, right? Which we did like dozens of space shuttle launches, right? Like it's like $1.8 billion in today's money per launch.
Well, it's still a lot. And I mean, it's a Wells lot, piece yeah. had back in 2018, of course, he's updated his views, but his old piece said just, if we don't do anything, it'll just plunge into the salty depths of the ocean, which was a perfect line. It was really great. Well,
it was a great line.
I think it would burn really up. Good one.
It would definitely burn up. There would be large sections that would burn up, but no,
that rocket that came down into the Indian Ocean this year.
Some of it went over New Jersey, didn't it?
Some this of it was went the over Utah.
So, too. So rockets are not coming in at Mach 25, right? So yeah. Like the or orbital speeds are a lot faster than like booster speeds, like first stage booster speeds.
Wait a minute. So you're saying that the International Space Station orbiting right now, if it just came down, it wouldn't be coming in at Mach 25 like the space rocket that came in down into the Indian Ocean recently. You're talking
the so I don't know what I don't know what you're referring to. But when you launch, like right. Usually, like when you launch, your first stage is like gets discarded into the ocean. But it's not ever reaching Mach 25.
Oh,
it's not ever going that fast.
Got it.
Right. So it's only trying to get you out of the atmosphere, and then like the second stage motor like turns on and gets you up to speed once we've done away with like atmospheric drag because they got you up there, right.
Well, that was my one dumb question for the podcast, but let's move on to something that I actually prepared for, which is the Chinese space station. And I was hoping, Eli, that you've been following this. You can give us a quick little brief on it.
I haven't followed that specific plan, but I mean, China is very serious about space. They are copying everything SpaceX is doing, but they're also like spending like tons of money to make a lot of progress really quickly. So they, you know, they have a rover on Mars. And they are they're very, very, very serious about being a spacefaring nation and being, you know, I think in their mind, they fully expect to surpass the United States, you know, sort of capabilities in space.
Well, then the next thing, the natural progression then is, how about private industry, right? There is this push for a commercial space station. At least you mentioned one. You said, isn't it time for a private space station in orbit? The scientists could go and do their experiments.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, so I think this is a podcast. I just wanted to hear more.
Kind of so this is, I think this is all bound up with what's actually like the single like revolutionary thing that's happening right now in space is Starship. Right. Yeah. So this is SpaceX's next rocket. So the Falcon 9 is like a workhorse. It's sort of lifting, I think, mass to orbit at a rate of like 2/3 of the existing mass to orbit, right? So like everything humanity is sending into space, like Falcon 9 is taking about 2/3 of it, right? One rocket system, right? And then like the Chinese are taking some, and like a few other small
Russians are taking some, yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Falcon 9 takes stuff up there for like something like $2,500-$2,600 a ton. Or sorry, a kilogram. $2,600 a kilogram, right?
Yeah.
Starship is being designed to be like take 150 tons to orbit. So bigger than not only SLS, but bigger than Saturn V, maybe, which was, you know, the Apollo rocket. And to do it, you know, like the ultimate aim is to do it for a fully burdened cost of $1.5 million. That's what Elon says, right? Like yeah. He thinks you can only get there with a high flight rate, right? But like he thinks that they're going to get there, right? So that works out, if you do the math, that works out to $10 a kilogram. So you go from $2,600 a kilogram to $10 a kilogram. That is a huge reduction, right? Two orders of magnitude.
Step right up. More. Here's the savings.
So I mean, like think about like how much more stuff we're going to send into space when it's $10 a kilogram, or let's say Elon's off by, you know, a factor of 10, right? Like it's $100 a kilogram versus $2,600 a kilogram, right? It's just going to be a game changer.
It makes so many new businesses possible, right? It makes
so many new businesses.
I mean,
possible.
The fact that we're even talking about Starlink, which I think is just the beginning of this, which is this, you know, kind of mesh satellite internet system, is to me, I think, kind of part and parcel of this entire conversation. Those things were much, much harder to do. There's only, you know, traditionally most of these other satellite companies have only two, maybe three satellites in orbit, and I believe, if I recall correctly, they're putting in 200 of these satellites in the next like 3 or 4 months
faster.
Yeah, it could be. In
yeah. So when they launch on a Falcon 9, they put up 60 satellites at a time. Right. And so if SpaceX is launching a Falcon 9 with Starlink satellites, every 2 weeks, 10 days, something like that, like which is what they've been doing. That is a lot of satellites. And now sometimes they don't put all 60 on, they make room for other customers and stuff to like sort of subsidize the cost of the flight. But you know, they are lifting them very quickly. Now Starship will take like 500 of them,
wow,
at a time. Right. So it is, and at lower costs, like the launch cost on Starship, even though it's 10 times has 10 times the payload as a reusable Falcon 9, it is going to be have lower launch costs, like maybe in absolute terms, than a Falcon 9. So it is just a massive game changer. So we're going to be sending a lot more mass to space.
Yeah.
But then also there's a second order effect also that's really important, which is that when launch is cheap, like it actually changes what you send up, right? So instead of like bespoke, like radiation hardened electronics, solid state components that, you know, are very unlikely to fail and so on, like you can actually like send cheaper hardware and have mechanical parts that might fail. And then if something goes wrong, like you just send it up again, right? You send up another one, right? So you can send consumer grade hardware. You can like send iPhone components. So like the radiation hardened like processors, do you guys remember the iMac G3? Like from like,
I do remember the iMac
20, G3. Like the like sort of like, I don't know, like candy, like sort of design. So that
we'll
is
put that
actually
in show notes.
So that is actually, all right. So some people, yeah, Caden might be too young.
Yeah, I'm way too young for that.
That is like the power PC, like the G3 power PC that was in that computer. Like there's a radiation hardware version, a radiation hardened version of that on the Mars rover. Like that is literally the same processor in terms of instruction set and like clock speeds. So we're using 20-year-old processors in our space equipment, because we need to be like super sure that it doesn't fail. So when launch gets cheap, then all of a sudden you get like 20 years of Moore's law kicking in on what you can put into space. So it's going to be, I think it's going to be very revolutionary. Like, I think by the end of the decade, like, you're going to see, so like, there's a company called Planet Labs that has a bunch of satellites that do like photography, like
Hubble telescope, you know, kind of stuff.
No, like down pointing at Earth, right? Like Google looking Maps kind of stuff. Like Google, like, so they are a supplier of data for Google Maps, right? And so I think that like, you're going to have like live Google Maps by the end of the decade, you're going to be like real time access.
We're getting into commercializing space, meaning there is this cooperation between the government and commercial startups, other companies that have technology that isn't just made by NASA, right? Like, they don't have engineers with tools and welders in their hands. They're just buying it from someone else. Eli, you recently had a piece, something like One Weird Trick to How the Government Learned How to Work with Startups. And Will, your piece about Bill Nelson and NASA actually had this in it too. I want to talk about contracts in terms of, how NASA can find the cheapest alternatives to things instead of just trying to do it itself. And I want to start with Eli probably.
Okay. So like the thing you have to contrast it with is like the contract that we have for SLS, right? So like, so in the SLS, like core stage contract, it is a cost plus contract, with a major, you know, defense prime. In this case, it's Boeing, right? So the core stage contract with Boeing is like, you know, we will buy a core stage from you, or design services for the core stage from you, and you know, we will pay whatever it costs you to do it, plus like a little extra, and plus like award fees for, you know, excellent performance, and just, you know, whatever it costs, like, you know, we'll pay that, right? And so that's how a lot of space stuff has been traditionally procured. And
because there's no problems with Boeing at all, right? Because there's right, it's just totally a perfect company.
Well, Boeing has won almost all of their performance awards at the end of these contracts, despite years of delay and cost overruns and many other problems. So
I'm sort of stealing this from Will. I'm pretty sure that this is Will's words.
Yeah. Right.
Oh yeah, no, exactly. I mean, especially with SLS. SLS, I think, is the foil to what we could be doing, right? That there's actually this, I mean, which I know Eli has done a lot of really, really good work on, which is the other way to do things, which is the commercial orbital right. transportation services sort of model.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in 2006, NASA tried to do a no bid contract award to a company called Kistler, and there was a little startup called this might have been 2004. There's a little startup called SpaceX that complained to the GAO and said, "Hey, you're doing this no bid award, and like that's not cool." And so NASA regrouped and was like, "Okay, we need a new launch system to take cargo to the International Space Station." And, you know, we apparently were not allowed to do a no bid award, so we're going to have some sort of process on this. And so what they came up with was the commercial orbital transportation services. Oh, and the other component of this was that Congress didn't give them a lot of money, right? It was like Congress said, okay, you have like $500 million to do this, right? And so, NASA like sort of figured out like, oh, we're not going to be able to get anything for this if we go through like Boeing or a company like that. And we're not allowed to just give it to Kistler. So let's have a little like kind of a contest and see what people can do. And let's sort of set the terms of this contest so that there's some sort of commercial benefit from it, because the amounts here are not big enough for a government owned program. And so they basically put out an announcement saying like, hey, you know, okay, space startups, like come to us with your launch ideas. We're not going to dictate requirements. We're going to dictate the goal, which is to bring cargo to the International Space Station. And we want to see your proposals. And we're going to issue two contracts on this basis. And the contracts are going to be not cost plus. They're going to be firm fixed. Payments, and they're going to be milestone driven. So you meet the milestone, like you unlock a level of payment. And so it turns out that that's like a killer combination, right? If you sort of like state the goals, not the requirements. So like NASA can't come in and then say like, make changes to the design halfway through because, you know, they're like, we're going to change the requirements. Like you just set the broad goal. You have a fixed price and you pay upon like completed milestones. Like that is a great way, it turns out, to get progress, to get progress. And so that, and it works in practice as well as in theory. Out of that program, we got the Falcon 9 rocket, which is, as I mentioned earlier, lifting 2/3 of all the mass to orbit, right? And then actually one of the awards, the other award besides the one to SpaceX went to Kistler, which was then called Rocket Plane Kistler. And they failed to meet a milestone. And so their contract was cut short. And then NASA awarded the leftover money to another entrant. So there was another company that came in and tried to do something with it. So the milestone driven thing actually was binding, right? Like they didn't just throw more money after the companies that were failing.
Yeah, if you didn't need it, you were done for, which Rocket Plane Kistler was effectively. I think this is what, in 2008, 2009, something along those lines?
Something like that, yeah. So they were just unable to raise like the private money they needed. Oh, and the other thing that's really important about the COTS program was like it didn't fund the entire development, right? Like because this was a commercial project, right? Like the company had an incentive to like top up the NASA dollars and like spend some of their own money doing R&D. So it was a program that like the companies valued highly enough and that had good enough performance that they wanted to spend their own money on. Yeah. So it was kind of really like a shared cost kind of model, giving something that NASA wanted. Yeah. And so then once these launch vehicles were developed, then NASA had could then like on the market, they could go and like buy from two different suppliers. They could buy freight services to the ISS, right? So the playbook really is like create a market in the service that you want to buy, right? So the service that they wanted to buy initially was cargo delivery to the ISS that didn't exist. And so then they use this like sort of like smart contracting structure to actually create a market in that service. And then, you know, then that market is expanding and taking on a life of its own where NASA is not the only customer. Right. And that's super valuable. So NASA has reused this playbook, right? NASA is like totally on board with this. They reused the playbook for the Commercial Crew program, which, is now, now has, SpaceX delivering, crew as well as cargo to the ISS. And it's, Boeing, was the other winner there, and maybe next year they will do another crew demo. They're behind schedule again. And then they're doing it. They did it. They're doing it right now again for the human landing system for the moon lander for the Artemis missions. Yeah. There's a little controversy there because SpaceX was the only company that won using the Starship. I mean, it's like Artemis is a little absurd, right? So they actually,
but the moon are launching us, Eli. It misses.
Yes,
us,
yes, right? It misses us. We need to go. We need to go back. Like, but the design of the mission is insane. They are launching astronauts on the space launch system, sending them to this orbiting space station, which hasn't been built yet, around the moon. And then from there, they are going to like take them, you know, pending the protests that Blue Origin has filed, pending that, they're going to transfer them from that orbiting space station to a Starship.
Yep.
That is
SpaceX
massive,
Starship. Yeah.
A SpaceX Starship. And then,
which has been previously launched to meet with them,
And then let them down on the moon, right? Yep. So, like, the smart way to do it is just to launch humans on a Starship. Like refuel all in space the and then just land on the moon, right? Like you don't have to do this whole like we're gonna have a different launch vehicle, like the SLS, which is probably unsafe, and then transfer them to this space station that still needs to be built, and then also put them down in a human landing system. So it is completely messed up, but at least for the human landing system, like NASA was like, we're going to use this sort of tried and true playbook, and it seems to have produced a good outcome. You know, unless we'll see if Blue Origin wins, you know, is able to win their appeal or not. I think they're also doing something similar for orbital space stations. I think they're doing the same model.
Yeah.
So NASA gets it.
Yeah.
I think NASA would do COTS everything if they could, right? At this point, like for a bunch of different things. And really the main obstacle is that Congress still wants lots of non-COTS programs to be able to provide jobs for people in their districts.
Well, that brings
there's a lot of to be blunt. I mean, just to put a really fine point on this, I think that before we go to this next issue, that ultimately what we're talking about here is that the SLS really is kind of a hangover from a previous era, right? And I think that really what we need to figure out now is how to retire this system. I mean, let's say gracefully. I think we need to retire it gracefully in some regard, probably go out through the rest of the current missions, but we need to generally transition into a more commercial minded focus, and in particular something that actually works with, you know, potentially works with Blue Origin and SpaceX, but also all these other sorts of competing players also coming into the fray. So all this is to say, space, you know, SLS, it's like if we didn't have SLS, we didn't have the overhang of SLS, that we could do a lot more with this money. We could help develop out this market in a much more robust manner. And that's, to me, really where we should be going. We should really be figuring out how to, you know, as Eli suggested, how to develop out these markets. And that's something that we're not really thinking about. My big thing, which I, you know, this is like a small little addendum to all of this. SpaceX has said as a company, they're looking to, you know, potentially launch into Mars in, you know, maybe 2024, maybe 2026. You know, there's a high likelihood there is the possibility that basically that SpaceX as a company goes to Mars before the actual project of Artemis itself is able to go to Mars under the current timeline. Which would be the U.S. government based system, and that to me is actually a really interesting conflict to watch over in the next decade.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got commercial companies like Blue Origin, like SpaceX. Paul Allen has something called Strata Launch Systems, and then there's Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic. But Bill Nelson just took over NASA, former Senator Bill Nelson from Florida. What's his path going forward? How does he keep NASA relevant? And is it a new path? Is it this COTS system on steroids, or what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, so Bill Nelson throughout his career has been very much in favor of the SLS model, right? And so it is, it's going to be jarring, but I think that the only way he can succeed is if he becomes an advocate for the sort of the COTS style programs, right? And in fairness, in his his first hearing, where Congress was really upset that Blue Origin and their national team Moonlander didn't get selected, you know, I think he's you know, been a defender of the model. He's like, you know, this will go to GAO and it will get sorted out, or it is sitting at GAO right now, I guess. I think he's so far he's defending the process. And I think, you know, he sees very clearly, it's like, okay, NASA or Congress wants, you know, their preferred companies to win these things. And we only selected one winner for this thing because NASA didn't give us, or Congress didn't give NASA enough money. Right. So he sees it as like these COTS style programs. I think now that he's in the position he's in, instead of he's the senator from Florida.
Yeah.
I think he sees that, the merits of the COTS style system.
And to be clear also about the piece I had, I was worried about his position at NASA as director, because he had this history as a Florida senator about really, really, really pushing for SLS, and also being really uncertain about commercialization in these early programs very, very early on. It seems that he's changed his position, which I commend him. If he in the last hearing, the most recent hearing, which happened, I guess when this comes out, it was probably last month. you know, that hearing, he actually defended the system. And he said, you know, I think, you know, he said something really, really folksy. It's like, oh, you can't get any more potatoes out of a 5-pound bag or something like that. Something like super fun and folksy. But he's right. Right. If Congress doesn't appropriate money for these projects, if they don't appropriate the right amount of money for SLS to be this kind of monstrosity and this albatross around our neck, then it isn't going to be the case that you're going to get any more projects other than the one that you've decided that you're funding, right? Like you can't do anything more if you don't have any more money. This to me doesn't make any sense. Now, of course, we need to think more comprehensively about SLS. And again, I think that the entire idea around space and what our space policy is really needs a better workable agenda, something that is more conscientious and thought through about how we're going to develop and maintain these markets and how we're going to go to Mars and how we're going to maintain development to the moon that doesn't have to necessarily involve this, you know, even this orbital system that the SLS is putting in, because I'm not even sure that it's really all that useful. All this is to say is that I still think that it really behooves Congress and probably even us as well to think through what a clean rewrite of an agenda would look like, that something that actually thinks through where we're at right now and where we're going to go in the future, especially with these other conflicts with the Russians, with the Chinese, and also with, you know, we haven't really at all talked about Europe, but Europe is another big market player in this. They're mm-hmm. struggling. A lot of the kind of the local suppliers, the EU derived space technologies are also they're butting up against American companies because they do see them as the American companies as doing very, very well in this market. And so there's also that sort of tension, which I think kind of needs to get resolved. I think they need to get kind of behind American technological know-how in this case. But yeah, that I think also probably won't happen because of political ramifications, and especially in France with Airbus and all the suppliers that are kind of related in that vertical. But I think that's a whole bunch of different issues. Coming up on time.
Yeah, I really underestimated the vastness of these questions. So we're running a little long, but
you think this is a clean, defined area that we're not going to be able to rant over and over and over again about?
Well, you know, I was hoping.
Okay.
But I'm hoping. Glad that it isn't, right? That was so much more substantive than I was hoping for. So, Eli, thanks for being on our show. Is there any last thoughts, though? I want to know if you have just like a one-liner at the very end, just to wrap it all up.
I mean, I think that we need to decide, like, what is it that we want to get out of our space program, right? Is it jobs on Earth? Is it national greatness, like planting flags on the moon, showing up the Chinese, et cetera? Or is it like progress in science, right? Where there's like tons of great projects to be done in space. Mm-hmm. Or is it commercialization, right? Opening up of new markets, right? Like, and to me, it's like those latter two is what we should be focused on. Whereas, I think most policymakers, including the ones that have authority over space, you know, especially in Congress on the committees, they care about the first two, right? It's like jobs and national greatness.
Yeah.
And let's try to drive like scientific and commercial progress instead.
That's great. Well,
couldn't say it better than that.
Yeah.
As always, thanks for taking a listen. Let us know if you have questions or comments. And with that, be well.